This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on February 17th. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky, and thanks to everyone who contributed to Co-op's spring membership drive last week. We couldn't do this show without your support. The nonprofit, nonpartisan Prison Policy Initiative issued a report last fall that investigated prison system responses to COVID-19. They point out that from the beginning of the pandemic, it was clear that densely packed prisons and jails presented dangerous conditions for the transmission of COVID-19. Here are some of their findings. State prisons and local jails appear indifferent to COVID outbreaks and refuse to depopulate dangerous facilities. Population declines are primarily due to reduced admissions, not increased releases. Just over half of incarcerated people are vaccinated despite being locked in COVID-19 epicenters. Most states did not prioritize incarcerated people in their vaccination plans. They cite a report that found that COVID-19 reduced the life expectancy of people in Florida prisons by 4 years. Analysis of data from 37 prison systems shows that less than half of prison staff are vaccinated in most states. Parole boards approved fewer releases in 2020 than in 2019, despite the raging pandemic. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Amanda Wu, Executive Director of the Texas Fair Defense Project. Their mission is to fight to end the criminalization of poverty in Texas. TFDP envisions a system of justice that upholds the dignity and civil rights of all people, regardless of income, race, or gender. We also have Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. And Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of the show, is with us too. Amanda, it's so good to have you back here again. How have you been?
You know, considering what the last couple of years have been like, I'm doing pretty well. It's so good to be back here.
Boy, you can say that again. You know, I think you were last with us in May of 2020. Would have been right at the beginning of the pandemic. And geez, so much has happened in that time, you know? I mean, we were all focused on COVID and with good reason, but the rest of the stuff that's gone on here is almost overwhelming. Well, we'll get into that. If you could just lead off and tell us a little about your background and some about TFDP.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, at Texas Fair Defense Project, we fight to end the criminalization of poverty in Texas. What that actually looks like is our advocacy includes direct legal services for low-income Texans who are trying to navigate their way out of the criminal legal system. We do a ton of policy advocacy at the local and state levels, and we also do impact litigation. Part of our work that's really expanded recently, I think, is what we consider community lawyering or movement lawyering, which is working with local advocates to get significant changes made to pieces of the criminal legal system. And really, we're focused on keeping people out of the system entirely. We know that it does incredible harm to families and individuals and communities, and has really been targeted against poor people and communities of color for, you know, decades, coming out of really a history of slavery in the United States. Mm-hmm. So our focus, you know, while we work with judges and courts, we really want to try to get people out of the system with as little harm done as possible. And our areas of focus right now to do that are bail. You know, a lot of people who are unable to afford bail are stuck in jail pre-trial without having been convicted, which is a huge injustice across Texas. Tens of thousands of people every day are stuck in jail because they can't afford to pay a cash amount. We work on public defense, which recently in our community meant starting the Travis County Public Defender Office, which is just totally thrilling to see how it's gotten off the ground in the last couple of years. We also do fines and fees and driver's license reform, help people who have an unaffordable traffic ticket debt get out from underneath that debt, get their driver's licenses back, and get them back on the road and out of the criminal legal system. And most recently, we started a program focused on record clearing work, helping people who do have some kind of criminal record get an expunction or non-disclosure so that they also can move on with their life. So our advocacy tools range significantly. We work hard to follow the lead of clients and communities that we serve, and we're really dedicated to helping low-income people disentangle from the criminal legal system. I joined TFDP 3 years ago, I guess almost 3.5 years ago now. More than half that time has now been in the pandemic, but we've grown a lot. Our staff is amazing, and I'm really excited about the work that we have ahead as well.
What an incredible array of issues and services that you provide there.
One thing I want to mention is that all of our work is done in partnership with clients and community partners and other organizations. So we know that we can only have an impact working closely with a, you know, broad group of people that's also building power at the same time to really dismantle the systems that we're fighting. So TFDP's work is amazing, and there's no way we could do it without the strength and partnership of our clients and community as well.
Well, when we last spoke about 2 years ago, the pandemic was still fairly new. Little did we know it was going to drag on as long as it has. But judges and sheriffs were desperately trying to reduce their jail populations at the same time that the governor was blocking their efforts. How has that conflict played out since that time?
I think the last time we talked, the governor had issued a couple executive orders that were really aimed at keeping people in jail at the same time as many local officials were realizing that jails were going to be hotspots for COVID, and that infections, of course, would not be limited to the jail. People go in and out of jail all the time, whether it's the people who are caged there or the people who work there. So I think those concerns were prescient, and unfortunately, they really played out. The executive orders that Abbott issued, a couple courts have found them unconstitutional, rightly so, because he basically unilaterally tried to change the Code of Criminal Procedure, which of course can't happen without the legislature. But there hasn't been a state level decision about the unconstitutionality of the executive order. So a lot of courts are still following the executive order. One thing I've noticed, you know, not just with Governor Abbott's order, but also with all of the changes that we've seen to court processes, is that people kind of are selective in how much they believe we're actually still in a pandemic. So of course, like Governor Abbott completely changed course on mask mandates, you know, just 6 months or so into the pandemic because of the backlash from the far right. But at the same time, he hasn't lifted these executive orders, which he purportedly issued because of the pandemic. So one thing that concerns me that we're seeing right now is all these changes to the systems and the broad overreach that we've seen by the governor and others are still in play because of how long the pandemic has lasted and how we don't really know. You know, it may never end. And so it's kind of been used as a way to change systems and grasp power that hasn't meaningfully been challenged, and that will likely stay with us for a long time.
Well, one would hope that some of this would go away with, you know, the day that the pandemic disappears, and, you know, and that may never happen, of course. But in the meantime, what I've read is that infections throughout the state have been widely variable. At one point, Travis County was doing reasonably well. Is that still the case, or what's your take on COVID in the county jails?
I think you're right to point out that it's been really variable. And it seems that right now across the state, including in the prisons and the jails, part of the problem that we're seeing is that a lot of correctional staff are not vaccinated. So the problems have been kind of whack-a-mole in the pandemic. While we focused on decarceration early, and I think, you know, some sheriffs and judges and other officials recognize the importance of those efforts, it did reduce the jail population significantly in Travis County, and some other places did as well. The population has kind of crept up since then, not to pre-COVID levels, but has crept up significantly from the initial drop that we saw. I mean, we can kind of understand why jails and prisons would be hotspots for infection. Just social distancing is impossible. But now with the variable vaccination rates, I think especially among correctional staff who have lower vaccination rates than the general population, they will continue to be hotspots for COVID as, you know, we possibly turn into an endemic as well.
Right. You mentioned, if I could pivot just a little bit here, you spoke about the Travis County Public Defender's Office, and that's been open just for a little more than a year now that it's been operational. What's your take on its track record so far?
We knew this when we, you know, worked on the grant application and really sort of plotted out what the office would look like in the first 5 years. Mm-hmm. They've really been in growth mode. The goal was for the office to take 30% of all criminal cases in Travis County within the 5-year grant period, you know, which is in the thousands of cases, of course. So they've really been doing a ton of hiring. I know early on, as an executive director, I can really sympathize and understand the like sort of operational challenges of just starting an office. So just like finding the right space and the right operational staff and doing all the hiring. And I think the office has been really, really focused on laying a strong foundation for what it'll look like going forward. And I think they've been doing a fabulous job. The lawyers that I know who are in the office are extremely client focused and dedicated and amazing advocates. And they're continuing to hire and grow. And one thing that really excites me about the office is that a public defender office can really be an institution within the county that pushes back against knee-jerk reactions to incarcerating people because of social harms. And we didn't really have that institutionally in Travis County. Like, we do have more progressive district attorney and county attorney now, but even so, a district attorney and county attorney, you know, their main jobs are to prosecute people, right? So right. Just having like a county funded, you know, almost internal player who can be part of county conversations around the jail and diversion programs and all of that, I think can really help move us in the right direction. And we even saw that with the women's jail fight that I know we're going to talk about in a little bit, back in June, when our chief public defender called into commissioner's court and spoke out, you know, among the 100 advocates, she was one of the people who called in to say, we don't need a jail. And that's a huge ground shift in Travis County to have someone who is paid by the county, who runs a county office, to really be pushing back against our sort of knee-jerk carceral reactions that we've had for so long.
I hear you. Well, speaking of the women's jail, that's kind of gone back and forth and sort of all over the place. It was kind of gung-ho until, was it about last June that they put the hold on it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was last June that the commissioners voted unanimously to put a hold on any plans for a year. But it was well before that. I mean, advocates before I came to TFDP had been fighting against these plans since they came out in 2016. So the whole process has been a really long process. And I think a lot of the advocates in Travis County who have been around for a long time really laid the groundwork for what happened in June. But that was just kind of the latest iteration of Commissioner's Court action, which was really the strongest showing that we had of halting plans to build more jails.
And did I read somewhere that part of the justification was that the jail population was declining? Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's right. So a little bit of background, the plans for the jail are actually part of this larger, quote, master plan that was developed by consultants in like 2015-ish. And the first part of the plan was building this new women's jail. And so when the plans were created, there was a projection that they would, quote, need 2,700 beds in the overall jail facilities. In June, when the vote came down in the women's jail, that number was closer to 1,300, 1,400. So it was really about 50% of what these, you know, consultants who were paid gobs and gobs of money said that, you know, would be the need. And I really want to shout out again the advocates who were working back then in like 2016 or so, because what they were saying was the number of people in jail in the county is really a policy decision. This is not just like raw projections that you make from the data. And what we really need to do is have a conversation about how we decrease the jail population as much as possible through, you know, pretrial release and decriminalization and, you know, less policing, no policing of poverty crimes and that kind of thing before we even talk about what our facilities should look like. And indeed, what they were saying really came true for a couple of different reasons. One was the pandemic, which I think really showed us the work that we should have been doing all along to reduce jail populations. And that was possible all along. But also the new district attorney and county attorney, I think, have also helped to reduce the jail population. And that just all goes to show exactly what the advocates have been saying, which is that the number of beds that you, quote, need in a jail, which, you know, a lot of us would argue with as a premise anyway, are really based on decisions that you make as county policymakers, and not some like random outside forces or some trends that you can plot out on a map based on what's happened in the past. So it's great to see how wrong that plan was, and that the jail was delayed for a year. But what we really need to do now is get rid of that erroneous carceral plan altogether and really plan to create a safe community that doesn't rely on jails and police for that safety.
And so, does that come down to diversion programs? I mean, do judges come up with more creative ways to deal with convictions? What's your vision on all this?
The Marshall Project, which you've probably seen before, it's like an online publication that's dedicated to reporting on criminal justice issues across the United States. They had an article where they asked people who were in prison, what could have kept you out of prison in your life? And the answers were things like housing, childcare, a job, job training. And I think ultimately those are the places that we need to put the investments. It's no coincidence that most people in our jail are poor. It's not because poor people are more violent or anything like that. It's because the root cause is poverty. And I think especially as in our community, housing prices have been skyrocketing, inflation is going up. We need to really focus on bringing up that basic level that people are operating at. And so diversion programs can only go so far because someone's already caught up in the system. And in a lot of diversion programs, it's a way to continue to keep them caught up in the system, you know, for them to have to meet certain onerous conditions and pay a lot of money. So I think really to get to the root causes of this, we need to be focusing on housing, which has been a huge, you know, issue that we have seen investments in from the county and the city, but also things like childcare, access to mental health care, to, you know, healthcare generally, education, the things we know that really address the root causes of poverty and violence.
A lot of what you're discussing sounds like, you know, what we heard from the folks who worked on reimagining public safety. Were you actively involved with that at all?
I was not personally. Our deputy director, Jessica Johnson, was on the task force. And yeah, I agree. They came up with that like 75-page report that I think creates a really amazing blueprint that our public officials, if they wanted to, could follow to really invest in community safety and health.
So much of what has happened here in the last couple of years, we had the, you know, the whole APD budget yo-yo that launched the reimagining public safety, and then the legislature came back with its strictures about what municipalities could and could not do with respect to police budgets. And we had Prop B, and then we had Prop A. Do you have any reflections on recent history about what all we've been through here? I'm guessing that certainly the stuff coming out of the legislature has got to be a concern, but what's your take on current events of the last 2 years?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And you don't have to cover it all.
I think one lesson from the Prop B fight, from like the backlash of the decriminalization of homelessness, is that at the same time as we are divesting from carceral approaches to social problems, we need to be investing in what we know works and keeps people safe. So the housing investments that the city and the county have made recently really should have been coupled at the time with the decriminalization efforts, because people should not be criminalized for not having shelter, but they also need shelter at the same time. So I do think there was a lesson learned there. I think that also, you know, after the uprisings, after George Floyd was murdered and Mike Ramos here in our community, there is a lot of talk among white people about racial justice. When the rubber hits the road, I don't think that people followed through with, like, you know, the talk and the Instagram posts and the Twitter posts and everything. And I think that a commitment to racial justice is not fad or a trend. It takes work. It takes self-examination. It takes, you know, arguing with your family and your friends and your neighbors sometimes, and hard conversations. And I think, like, almost the Reimagining Public Safety Task Force did incredible work, but at the same time, politically, you know, the council kind of got all this free labor out of a ton of amazing advocates, and it was really on them and our other public officials to pick up the report and do something with it. And I think we need strong, fearless in some ways, public officials who are really willing to follow through with what they profess their values are and what the community professes its values are. I see this moment in our community as a serious question of what are our values and how do we actually hold ourselves to them? Because we like to say how progressive Austin is, but the crises that we're seeing in housing and affordability and some of the backlashes on the decriminalization, I think are really sort of questioning what it means to call yourself progressive. And I hope we can live up to our professed values. And then the state's a whole other thing. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's challenging. It's like, it's really challenging. The backlash and the back and forth, but I guess it takes building, you know. No victory is guaranteed and no victory is like self-executingly permanent, you know, like it takes ongoing power building and dedication to actually move forward.
I'm wondering if, as you look around the state, you see any localities that you would hold up as better than others or better than the average?
Oh, man, it's hard. We're limiting to Texas. I guess it would depend on, like, on what. So, like, in Harris County, we were part of litigation that challenged the misdemeanor bail system. And the reforms that came out of that litigation through a rule that the judges enacted and consent decree, I think were like a huge step forward and could be a model for other jurisdictions on bail and pretrial release. But I also know that, like, I don't know, part of me, and Jim, I'm sure you understand this, is like, I know we can always do better, So even when you're holding up a community or a policy as something that, like, you know, might be the best that we've seen, there's still things that we can, you know, learn about it where we can look even better. And that's kind of the challenge I'd like to bring to, like, Travis County and Austin is, like, how can we, like, continue to strive in a way that is, like, not self-defeating or anything, but really, you know, tries to set us apart in a way that understands that that's an evolving process.
What do you think slows that down in Travis County?
I think that in some ways, the fact that we're all Democratic, I think makes people less willing to fight in some ways. Like, you know, there's like a go along, get along almost. And like, you're going to have to take on other Democrats. Like, there is a lot of variation within the party on these issues. And like, we're going to have those fights. And I think that a lot of public officials, whether, I don't know the inner workings of the Democratic Party here or anything, but I think they're afraid to bring the fight. And it's like easier when the other person is an R, because that's the person you're supposed to be fighting against. So yeah, I think people are reticent, you know, in part because it's supposedly not very varied, but actually, like, politically, there's a tremendous amount of variation. And people are just kind of wedded to the status quo. Like, I think a lot of folks who have been around for a while tend to feel defensive, you know, when people say we haven't come far enough, and sometimes lack imagination. I also think that, like, being the blue dot in the red state sometimes lets us pat ourselves on the back a little too much. You know, we need to be looking outside of Texas or even outside of the United States for ideas. It's almost like a complacency with, like, calling yourself liberal. Like, that's just not enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think we sort of saw that play out with Bridget Shea in the women's prison. And you see it in the political advertising right now, in the way the endorsements have come out, right? And I'm wondering, you know, as I was listening as you talk, this seems to me to be a problem generally with the party, and probably it's true of any party, is this lack of openness to new ideas from the entrenched leadership. You know, a lot of this is status quo. A lot of this, of course, involves friends and all that kind of thing. And also, I think you're right. I think Austin has this insular progressive idea that is a lot more progressive than it really is.
Yeah, to what you said, Jim, I totally agree. And in some ways, it has to do with power. And like, people are like, well, I hold power. I mean, this is not like a conscious thing or anything, but it's about, you know, holding on to your position, your power. And a certain someone has power in their position, and their friends do, and their donors, therefore, it insular is kind of the word. It's protectionist and insular.
We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on February 17th. Our guest is Amanda Woog from the Texas Fair Defense Project. Let's pick up where we left off.
Michelle, did you have anything to add to that?
The movement that I'm kind of becoming familiar with, which is the transformative justice movement. And I'm just curious, from your perspective at TFDP, whether or not you have any kind of thoughts on that. I know there's talk about it within some of the grassroots organizations here in Austin, like Austin Justice Coalition and the Communities Color United and such. It's a concept that I've been reading up on and curious how it's been playing out within the other justice circles around Austin and the state.
The thing that I love about the transformative justice movement, and I think some people are like more familiar with restorative justice, which tends to be like interpersonal between two people and centers around like accountability in the relationship that has been ruptured. What I think is so great about transformative justice, I would love to, you know, think of how it could be internalized in policymaking almost, but it really creates this like, you know, iterative learning, evolving process of examining harm within systems that allowed the harm to come about or even perpetrate the harm, and think of it as how do we change the systems that were in place that allowed this to happen, and has less focus on the individual. I think that has the potential to, you know, double using the word, transform the way that we think about harm and violence. And I think it's really exciting as an idea from a policymaking perspective. It would be cool to have those processes somehow internalized and thinking about policy and rethinking it. But I haven't really seen that happen at all among the powers that be. But it might just be like a, you know, a grassroots movement tool. But I think it's extremely effective, and it forces us to examine things like, you know, capitalism and racism in a way that there is absolutely no space to in the criminal legal system that is so focused on punishment and individuals.
And property.
And property, exactly.
Well, going through your website and responding to some of your opening remarks, TFDP is involved in a lot of different efforts right now. You mentioned pretrial reform, for example, cash bail. Every state legislature session seems to have this on its list, and so far it's gone nowhere. Do we just give up on that? Do we keep fighting for some reform at the state, or is there hope for more local efforts?
Yeah, unfortunately, bail has gone worse than nowhere in the legislature, because they actually did end up passing a bill in like the third special session this summer that restricted use of personal bonds, which are like basically the only way for someone who has zero money to get out of jail. It's a no-cost bond, and did some other harmful things, including targeting charitable bail organizations that help people come up with cash to get out of jail. So that was, you know, our posturing was mostly on the defense last legislative session. I do hope that we'll be working on something that will give a positive vision for pretrial reform in Texas. But, you know, we understand the environment that we're working in, and on the state level, we just might be on the defense on some issues for some time. But it's important to continue to be there because, as you mentioned, the local efforts that can take hold in lieu of any kind of quality state bail reform. So I do think it's worth it to continue to put forward positive visions in local jurisdictions while fighting back on the sort of inevitable backlash that we've been seeing on the state level.
Is there any legal challenge going on to the legislature interfering with the judge's ability to set bail?
So do you mean through the executive order, like the executive order that Governor Abbott came down with when the pandemic hit that sort of limited judges' discretion? Yeah. I don't know if there's anything live right now, Jim. The litigation that's been successful has been through habeas writs for individuals, you know, where arguments about the constitutionality of the executive order are made within the context of trying to get a single person released from jail. And then in multiple cases, judges have held that the executive order is unconstitutional within those writs. You know, we filed suit originally in the Supreme Court of Texas back in, I think, April 2020, but the Supreme Court of Texas basically said these challenges need to be working their way up through the individual cases. And so, you know, those have been happening, and the ones I mentioned are only the ones that I know of, and it's very possible that defense attorneys have been challenging the executive order in other contexts and places, but it hasn't worked its way up through the appellate or the Court of Criminal Appeals, you know, such that there's been a statewide or even like regional ruling.
I was pleased to see the focus on driver's licenses and your Freedom to Drive initiative. When you think about the importance of being able to drive, and it's absolutely essential for making money, for holding down a job. Kudos to you on that. Making any progress on that?
Thank you. Yeah. And this is one of the issues that we kind of use all the tools in our tool belt around. We help individuals have worked locally and at the state. It's actually one of the issues where we're able to get real traction at the state level. Two sessions ago, we helped repeal the driver responsibility program, which is just a terrible name for the program. I hate to even let it leave my lips like that. But the DRP would assess people's surcharges for certain traffic-related offenses, but there were actually ones that are related to poverty. So like driving without insurance, driving while license invalid. And then this program was so screwed up that like people didn't even know when they were assessed these surcharges. And then next thing they knew, their license would be suspended when they didn't pay. And then if you don't have any money, you're not paying yourself out of that hole that's been dug that you didn't even really know about. So we were able to help get that repealed a couple of years ago. And when that was repealed, $2 billion in debt that had been amassed under the program was erased. And hundreds of thousands, close to 1 million people were able to get their driver's licenses back. So that was the major state victory that we had recently. Last legislative session, we were able to get a couple more victories having to do with automatic suspension of licenses when someone is convicted of a drug offense. Those laws that we were able to get changed, we haven't been able to get reliable numbers, but we estimate probably in the hundreds of thousands of people get their licenses back and also ensure that suspensions wouldn't happen moving forward. So that issue, we've actually been able to make really great headway on. Our next focus will be on the Omnibase program, which is a court program that judges use to suspend someone's license when they don't pay their court debt, which is often like a traffic ticket debt. These programs are run through the county. So we've been doing local advocacy. We've gotten the city of Austin, the city of Dallas, and Harris County to withdraw from the program. We're going to be working in Bexar and Travis counties to come next and try to do reforms to the program coming up in the next legislative session. I also just want to shout out really quickly our clients who have been such incredible advocates in all of these successes, because there's nothing like someone coming up and telling their story about how they're trying to just get by and get a job and take their kids to school and how impossible it is with all these programs that have nothing to do with, you know, dangerous driving or anything to do with that, have everything to do with income and access to resources. So our clients have been incredible advocates in getting this work done too.
You also mentioned record clearing. Could you say a little more about that?
So in Texas, some people who have been arrested or have been convicted for low-level crimes are eligible to petition for expunctions or non-disclosures. And they're just like slightly different ways of clearing someone's criminal record. One of the ways that TFDP intervenes and in how we decide like which legal services to provide is, while a person has a right to an attorney in their criminal case, if there's a possibility that they'll face jail time, there are so many different pockets and facets of the criminal legal system where someone doesn't have a recognized right to an attorney, but if they don't have any money, then they're kind of screwed. And someone who does have money is able to successfully navigate the criminal legal system. So an example is like Class C and traffic tickets. If you can pay your traffic ticket, you're good. You move on with your life. If you can't pay your traffic ticket, you can get a warrant. You can get your license suspended. It can create this like major hole that is really hard to dig out without legal help. And so we recognized that the area of criminal record clearing, because it's really after someone's case is done, they no longer have an attorney, if they ever did have an attorney appointed, that was another area where, you know, if you had money, you could successfully navigate it, get your record taken care of. If you didn't, you would continue to carry this record with you. And of course, we know that criminal records can affect everything from eligibility of student loans to housing to employment. So it's really a way to continue to help people disentangle themselves from whatever their criminal legal involvement was.
You also list probation assistance. What is that about?
Oh, this is another kind of area that we've identified sort of similarly, you know, where if someone has access to resources, they can kind of get out from underneath the thumb of the system. Whereas if they don't, they're sort of trapped. So if someone's on probation, a lot of times it's really expensive. So the terms of the probation, they have to take certain classes or they have to, you know, maintain certain insurance, or they even have to pay for their own probation supervision. Probation departments get money from the people that they are surveilling and monitoring to continue to operate. So it's extremely expensive for someone to be on probation. And if they haven't paid that, they can also get their probation extended. So you could be on probation kind of indeterminately if you just don't have any money. On the other hand, in Texas, if you have successfully discharged your probation, you've successfully you know, met all the terms of your probation, halfway through, you actually are eligible to discharge probation entirely, meaning, you know, your probation term can end. So we kind of realized that, like, you know, people who have money who are able to keep up with all their stuff, you know, a 3-year probation term ends up being a year and a half for them. But people who aren't able to do that, they just get further and further behind. You know, not only are they unable to discharge their probation, even if they're otherwise successful, but their probation term can get extended. So we started a program that started with an Equal Justice Fellow, where she is representing people who are on probation, discharge the court debt, so that that's not one reason for them to not become in compliance, and then help them get off of probation early. And she's done an amazing job in her advocacy. I'm super proud of the program.
It almost sounds like the system has in place measures to make sure that the divide remains there, you know, and if you're poor, we're not going to let you out, you know?
Yeah, it's almost like the rich stay rich and the poor stay poor, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the essence of the system, of the capitalist system that we have. You know, that's the core of it. Yeah. And we saw this, you know, in the pandemic, the rich got richer as a result of the pandemic, you know, giving themselves the federal aid, for example. And then you have the poor folks, the people who are going to be exposed to the criminal justice system more likely, you know, losing a rent supplement, all those kinds of benefits.
We just got a few minutes left, Amanda. Were there things that you wanted to mention that I may have glossed over or omitted entirely?
I don't think so, actually, Bob. You did a great job of like getting me able to talk about like a lot of the great stuff that TFTP is doing. There's one thing I would love to highlight that's kind of coming up. I don't know if that was your next question, but sort of some of the stuff we're going to be focusing on.
Exactly, yes. Looking forward.
Yeah, so looking forward, we talked about the women's jail fight, and that was only a piece of this master plan that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So in 2016, the county spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on consultants who came up with a 10-year, $600 million plan for investing in jails and other kind of carceral facilities and institutions. And the women's jail was the first step in this whole, probably now $1 billion if you think about inflation and rising costs of housing and construction in Austin. And so I think what we really want to focus on is moving past the women's jail conversation, making sure that doesn't happen, of course, but doing away with this entire plan that was based on erroneous jail projections and based on past policies that have changed. And I would love for our community to focus on a plan to take that $600 million or $1 billion over 10 years and aim it at what we know are the drivers of poverty and incarceration. So that's what we're going to be working on with partners. The women's jail fight will likely come up again. Honestly, it shouldn't even be a conversation at this point, but it's the larger plan, I think, that the county really needs to step away from and start planning for things that actually help their residents who are suffering the most right now.
If I get this properly, you're trying to redirect some of that money in more positive and progressive rather than to continue to punish.
You know, thinking holistically about what makes healthy, safe communities. And police don't prevent crime. Jails don't support families. And yeah, thinking about what $600 million could be invested in when we really think about what a healthy and safe community would look like.
Putting teeth into what the Reimagining Public Safety Task Force had envisioned.
Exactly. So much of this work has been done within our community already. And I think it's time to pick it up and do something with it.
Thank you for all the fantastic work you're doing, and good luck as you go forward.
Thanks, Jim. We're going to need it.
Best wishes on all the projects that are going on with Texas Fair Defense Project.
Amanda, you're a real inspiration. It's been a real honor to have you back on the show again, and we wish all of you the very best in your efforts.
Thank you so much. I have such a wonderful time speaking with y'all. I'm really glad to be back and hope you're all staying happy and healthy.
More information about the Texas Fair Defense Project can be found at fairdefense.org.
It's Friday afternoon, March 4th. Austin Sanders is not available to join us today, but we have Brant Bingaman, also a writer for the Austin Chronicle. How you doing, Brant?
I'm doing good, Bob. Thanks for letting me come on your show.
Well, it's great to have you here. Brant and Austin cover APD issues. Brant, you were originally brought on to deal with death penalty issues, correct?
That is correct. And I do enjoy doing that reporting.
Oh, good. I was just joking with you. That's the icon or the image of Greg Abbott in a syringe, right?
Yeah. And I was saying that my wife deplores that image. She hopes that the art department will replace it soon.
Okay. Well, it's certainly striking, you know, and it catches your eye. But anyway, yes. Most recently here, I noticed that yesterday there was yet another settlement, I think by city council, in the matter of civil suits brought against the city for APD conduct in the handling of the racial protests 2 years ago, 2020, the BLM protests. Tell us about this latest settlement.
Well, it's a settlement on behalf of Brad Levi Ayala, who was a 16-year-old person when he was shot on May 31st, 2020, allegedly by Officer Nicholas Gebhardt. Levi was watching the protests from a hill that is parallel to the highway. He was watching the officers chase protesters off of the highway. And allegedly, Officer Gebhardt shot him at a distance of about 80 feet and shot him right in the forehead. The round penetrated his skull and he was rushed to the hospital and then endured a 7-hour surgery. His family, meanwhile, during the surgery, was waiting in an adjacent room, praying, literally praying that he wouldn't die because they had been told by the doctors that that was a possibility.
And this was all, I might add, less lethal rounds, correct?
Yeah, these were the so-called less lethal rounds, the so-called beanbag rounds. What they are is like a small little bag filled with lead shot. They expand when they're shot out of these modified shotguns, and they're supposed to kind of hit in about a 2 or 3 inch diameter area. They're supposed to be shot at a person's body. They're not meant to be shot at people's heads, but almost all of the cases that wound up being indicted by District Attorney Jose Garza, in almost all those cases, that's what happened. Officers shot people in the head with these.
So this is the third settlement in recent days. Was it last week or the week before we heard about $8 million for Justin Howell and $2 million for Anthony Evans? Tell us a little about those cases.
In Howell's case, he was also shot in the head. He was shot in the side of the head, allegedly by mistake. And he spent approximately 3 weeks in the ICU afterwards. And he also, his family feared he was going to die. His attorney, Jeff Edwards, tells me that the effects of the shooting are going to be with Mr. Howell for the rest of his life. But he's slowly getting back on track and recuperating. In the case of Anthony Evans, another person shot in the face, he was shot in the jaw, again, with one of these beanbag rounds. It crushed his jaw, and he had to endure several painful surgeries to begin to recuperate. So, as you said, Howell got $8 million. Evans got $2 million. Brad Levi Ayala has now gotten $3 million. Another protester we haven't spoken about much, Ariana Chavez, also, she got a settlement with the city in February for $150,000. There's still more settlements to come in some of those cases. Cases like Sam Kirsch, Kristen Warkoszewski, Tyree Talley, Bomani Barton. Millions more is going to wind up being paid out by the taxpayers of the city of Austin.
Austin Sanders did a story last year about the mounting settlements. And, you know, I don't remember the exact amount, and excluding the one in December for 60-some million dollars. But before that, I think the total of the ones that he had been covering in recent years wasn't even 20 million. And it sounds like the suits arising from the protests here, the BLM protests, could easily exceed that the way things are going right now.
Yeah, one of the interesting questions is, are some of these cases going to be taken to trial? You know, it could be said that the city is getting out cheap by just having to pay $8 million or $3 million or $2 million because of that Landon Nobles suit last December, in which the city was found liable for a $67 million settlement, which was almost 20 times more than any previous settlement they had ever had to pay out.
Right. Now, just for our listeners' sake, what we're talking about here, again, are specific civil trials. But then on the same day that City Council approved the settlements for Evans and Howell, totaling about $10 million, Jose Garza, the DA's office, issued 19 indictments against APD officers. Now, those are on the criminal side, correct?
That is correct.
So the civil suits will continue, but each of these 19 indictments, will they all result in trials themselves then?
Hard to say. Anything could happen with those. Cases could be dropped. The officers could agree to plea deals. But if they do go to trial, and if an officer is found guilty of the charge, which is assault with a deadly weapon in each of these cases, he would face 5 to 99 years in prison and a possible $10,000 fine. So that has got the police establishment very, very concerned for good reason. It's amazing that we're talking about 5 to 99 years in prison for this misconduct.
Well, Ken Cassidy has certainly had a few words about all this, but even Spencer Cronk has not been too happy with these indictments.
It's true. And he made what many considered a kind of outrageous statement. He said that he agreed with Chief of Police Joseph Chacon that none of the conduct described by the district attorney rose to the level of a crime. It's a bit of a stretch when you consider that people like Brad Levi Ayala, common sense seems to tell you that they were just watching the protests. Ayala wasn't on I-35. One of the interesting things about the statements of the city manager is that he seems to be agreeing with the police officers' defense attorneys, Ken Irvin and Doug O'Connell, that the way to handle the situation is by paying off the people who were hurt and not holding the individual officers responsible for shooting them.
Boy, I hope he's got a lot of money.
It's going to take, I mean, the money's going to go out one way or another, probably, but but the whole idea of attorneys and a city manager saying that we must not hold people responsible for possible crimes, it's a strange position for them to be in.
And, you know, all of this began with hundreds of complaints that were issued with the Office of Police Oversight. We spoke with Farrah Muscadin last summer about all this. Her annual report listed the number of complaints resulting from the BLM protest in the hundreds, but at that point, she wasn't ready to say anything about them. I guess she was waiting for APD to respond. And now we've got the DA indictments and we've got all these civil suits. It sounds like it's going to be quite a while before all of this is cleaned up.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably never going to be satisfactorily cleaned up, really. Yeah. One of the things that criminal justice advocates say is that the reason that we have to rely on the district attorney to handle the situation is because the internal affairs investigators at APD don't tend to discipline the officers. And if they do, it's kind of hard for the public to ever figure out what exactly happened because they won't tell you what the discipline was. You know, they've been very opaque throughout this entire process. And this is something that Austin's working on right now. He's trying to figure out if any officers were ever actually disciplined for their conduct during those protests. Back in December of last year, APD put out a statement saying that 11 officers had been disciplined. Now there's questions as to whether or not that actually occurred. We're wondering how many officers were investigated. How many of those hundreds of complaints forwarded by the Office of Police Oversight was actually looked at? The number is going to be crazy low. But it's hard to even find out because IA at APD is so opaque. It's not exactly transparent.
Well, we'll certainly be watching as this continues to develop. So really appreciate your joining us here today, Brant, and hope we can get you on again sometime soon.
I hope so too, Bob. Thanks very much.
That's all from us this evening. Thanks again to those of you who contributed to Co-op's Spring Membership Drive last week. Stay tuned for the local music mix next on the HD3 channel and on co-op.org. Stay safe, everyone.